Hello and welcome to I Am the Eggpods with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by author of The Beatles 101, it's Vicky Riley.
Hello. Hello. It's so mad to hear you say that, those lines in front of me, listening to them so often, listening to your podcast.
I still have to write them down. I still haven't remembered them.
You've not memorised them yet.
Such is my memory. I've been reading loads of great things about your book. Tell me about Beatles 101.
Have you? Well, that's a delight to hear. I mean, it was just something that I did on a whim, actually, which is quite strange. And it just baffles me every time somebody reads it and tells me that they like it. You know, I've worked in publishing for a long time, but to be part of it from the other side as an author has been quite strange.
Yeah, what drove you to write it?
As I say, I've worked in publishing for a while, and I used to work with a guy who has started his own publishing company, and within his publishing company, it's called Polaris. They mostly do sports books, but they're branching out into popular culture books as well. And he has a series of books called 101. So there was like rugby, Scottish rugby 101, yeah. All that kind of stuff. And we were, you know, just chatting at Frankfurt Book Fair, as you do.
Where else?
He was just like, when are you going to write me a Beatles book? And I just sort of laughed in his face because I've never written a book before. And I was like, haha, because everybody that I've ever worked with knows that I'm a bit of a Beatles obsessive. Yeah. So it's often the way. And he just kept, yeah, it's like, oh, ask Vicky her opinion about the Beatles and you'll never get away. And he just, every time I saw him, he kept asking me, when are you going to do that book? And I was just laughing. And then just one night, I just got an Excel spreadsheet up and I decided that if I could name what the 101 chapters would be without looking up Wikipedia, without Googling anything, if I could just come up with the 101 chapters off the top of my head, then I would do it. So I just sort of started typing in the chapters that I would do, and they pretty much ended up being the 101 chapters. Yeah. And then I'd finished and I was like, oh no, that means I should do it. So I sort of went to him and I was like, okay, I'll do this for you. And so I just started writing it. I mean, I know what it is. Like, I know it's not like, you know, I would never compare myself to those writers that have done, you know, the big definitive or the really narrative driven Beatles books that we all know and love. I know it's like a sort of good primer for new fans coming into the story, or just a little thing for maybe like big fans like us to dip in every so often, maybe just to remind themselves of something. Yeah. So yeah, I'm totally aware that it's more of a sort of toilet book or a stocking filler book or something like that.
But it's not enough Beatles toilet books.
Well, there should be more, you know. You've got to know who played what when you're on the toilet. I guess because of the format as well, for a first book to do, that helped me sort of break it down and not make it such a huge thing in my head that, oh my God, I'm writing a book sort of thing. Yeah. So it was really enjoyable, and it completely reopened my teenage self. It's like I completely went back to that space where I was obsessed as I was when I was a teenager. Because, you know, like you go through when you're in your first flush phase, when you're getting to know everything but then I sort of got over it a little bit when I sort of started working and all that kind of thing. But over the last year, I've just gone completely back to that place, and podcasts have completely helped that. And I want to join in as well. This is the thing. I listen to your podcast usually on a Sunday night before getting back to, you know, sort of getting relaxed to go back into that headspace for work in the morning. And I usually have a bath, and I'm always lying in the bath wanting to join in the conversations that you have with everybody. And then I was like, what would I say? Oh, I would say this. Oh, I don't agree with you there.
Thank you for not saying you listened to it on the toilet. I do appreciate that.
No.
But no, I have to say, because you're quite unique, really, because in the great scheme of things, aside from family, friends, there's not that many female Beatles authors. I think I can name Christine Feldman Barrett.
Yeah.
And then a struggle.
Yeah, you're right, actually. Yeah. There's a book, there's a John Lennon book that I put on my wish list on, though the author's escaped my head. It's one particular, it's more about John Lennon. And yeah, it is something that needs to be redressed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because I think, like, what people have said about my book is that my excitement and my enthusiasm comes through, and I hope that's what I wanted to come through. And I think it'd be good to hear more female voices to get excited in that way about the Beatles, because particularly since the Beatles have split up and they're now a part of the cultural firmament, the chat about the Beatles can be a little bit chin strokey and muso. Yeah. And one of the things my sister said was, say, don't forget to talk about how sexy they are. And I was like, yep, I will. And so I'm going to bring a little bit of that into it.
Definitely. Definitely.
I mean, I don't mind the chin strokey bits and stuff. I mean, I absolutely read all the chin strokey stuff. But sometimes it's nice to just sort of, you know, get into that Beatlemania headspace and scream along with the girls.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tell me, when did you first discover the Beatles?
Well, I mean, you always know the Beatles if you grow up after they existed, you know, because they're just there all the time. So I was sort of aware and unaware of them throughout my childhood. Like, they would get played on the radio and we would sing Beatles songs at school and at nursery and stuff like that. But I didn't properly, consciously got into them as a fan until I was about 13, about in the early 90s. I don't know how it happened, actually. It was just on a whim. It was a summer holidays from school, and my pal Linda, that we grew up beside, her brother had obviously been playing them a lot, and she was just sort of saying to us, oh, my brother keeps playing the Beatles and they're really good. So I asked her to make me this compilation tape. I don't know why I specifically said, make me a compilation tape with Sgt. Pepper's on it and then whatever you fancy. So this first compilation tape had that whole album, and then just a sort of mixture of odds and sods in no particular order as well. Yeah. Like, she put Ain't She Sweet on it.
Wow.
Which, you know, I know, which is, you know, one of the most well-known Beatles numbers. But still from listening to that compilation tape, every time Revolution finishes, I always expect to hear Ain't She Sweet, because you know how sometimes you get used to a track listing.
Yeah.
And so even now, even though that's not how I've listened to Revolution for ages, I always sort of think Ain't She Sweet as soon as that all right at the end Revolution. And then another friend at school also made me a compilation tape. So that's how I sort of came to know the Beatles. Yeah. And I just sort of slowly, you know, built the collection.
Yeah. So the album that you've picked is Past Masters Volume 1. Why have you picked this one?
Mm-hmm. I picked this one because I have a really big love. I mean, I love everything about the Beatles. I wouldn't be here otherwise. But I have a real big soft spot for the early years stuff. Just the joy and the excitement and the weaving of all the influences that informed the early Beatles sounds, you know. I like, because, you know, as I said, they were the kind of sort of gateway, and I absolutely adore girl groups and old rock and roll and early soul music, early Motown, Smokey Robinson, all that kind of stuff. And to hear the way they distilled all those influences into their sounds, just, it still excites me. I can't get bored from hearing, oh, that reminds me of that, and hearing the way that they use their influences in their music. And a lot of the time, you know, folks say, oh, the Beatles didn't really start cooking as songwriters until, I don't know, like Rubber Soul or something. Because I think people now, because we're sort of far and advanced in pop music language now, people forget and take for granted the leaps that the Beatles were actually making with each of their early records, and they don't appreciate the pioneering things that they were doing. And now, so it's just sort of considered as simple pop songs, when actually with each song, they were progressing what pop music could do, and just a little twist in a little way, and that kind of thing excites me as well.
So the album was originally released as two separate albums, Past Masters Volume 1 and Past Masters Volume 2. This was on the 7th of March, and it was part of a Beatles box set as a bonus. And then they were released separately later on the 10th of November 1988. And ostensibly, it's B-sides, the German single, Long Tall Sally EP, and a song that was only available in the US. So this was kind of replacing things like collection of Beatles oldies and rarities, which were never the biggest sellers, but it was so useful at the time.
Yeah, it's pretty much everything that they released that wasn't on an album.
You know? The only way you could get stuff before rarities, you would have to dig out all the singles to get the B-sides and buy the EP, and it's a real faff, and it's not a way to sit down and listen to it and enjoy it. I suppose you could do mixtapes or something like that, but there was a definite demand for it. Love me do. Whoa, love me do. So let's crack on with the album. So we start with track one, Love Me Do, recorded on the 4th of September 1962. And this was actually their first single, briefly, and then it was replaced with the Andy White version. So this has got Ringo on drums, also got some out-of-tune bass. But what are your thoughts?
See, so I don't notice the out of... Like, I like the fact that the Beatles kept the mistakes in.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I think pop music nowadays, and I don't want to sound like an old fart, but like the fact that they auto-tune everything to death just takes the aliveness of music out of it, just by, you know, machining it to death. But Love Me Do is, it's just, you can't help but love Me Do, can you? You know, it's just so cute. And in this single version, the thing that you can hear from it is the nerves as well, which I think is really sweet too. Particularly Paul on vocals,
Very shaky.
You can hear, it kind of reminds me of his vocals in the Decca editions as well, like Dreamers Do, where you can sort of hear the wobble and hear the tightness of his throat.
It's weird. George sounds the most confident in the Decca tapes.
I know, that really is weird. The weird thing about the really strange thing about the Decca edition is that you can hear George having a ball and all the rest of them are just sort of like, oh, which is weird. Like when you read back to the really early Beatles and this particular period in time, like sort of that 62 period when they were just at the cusp of becoming recording stars, you know, the nerves of John and Paul do kick in the story in a way that they never did with George. Mm. I find like the confidence that George had in the Beatles and their abilities never wavered at all in their early period, whereas both Paul and John had wobbles of this is never going to work out. And I love that about George, that he was just like, this is our due, man. I love the fact. And it was George that kind of saved them in a way as well from the early record. Can you imagine what would have happened if George hadn't said, well, I don't like your tie for a start, you know? Like, it seems that Paul and John were probably a little bit too overawed by the moment.
Yeah.
And George saved the day. I love that about George.
I wonder if he was, because, you know, John and Paul were the real drivers for everything at that particular point. And George was just on the ride, effectively, because he was still very much a kid. So if it hadn't worked out, he could have just gone on and done something else. He obviously wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
There's stories of him when he was a kid. He was very, very cocky. And
I love that. I love the thought of like a 12-year-old George Harrison with his big quiff and his pink shirt rocking up to school being like, yeah, so what? Yeah.
So I guess like the authoritarian figure of George Martin, he's got mum and dad with him, as in John and Paul, pick who you want to be, whoever. And he's kind of got that don't like your tie thing going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And Yeah, and that's the start, that's the beginning, that's the start of it. But, like, I do like this version, though. I do like Ringo's cute drumming, and I mean, I do prefer the album version. You can hear the difference in the album version. They're much looser, they're much more relaxed, and also the adding of the tambourine does lift it. Mm. So well done, Ringo, for your tambourine work. Don't feel sorry for the fact that you were relegated to the tambourine. Yeah. It lifts the song.
It does.
And because I was listening this week, I was listening to all different versions, and I listened to the anthology version with Pete as well. Mm. And you know, I feel really sorry, like that version makes me a little bit heartsick hearing that version, because I mean, if you think that there's nerves in the Ringo version, there is nerves galore with with everybody in the Pete Best version. Yeah.
Love me do. Love me do. Love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please love me do.
I have a lot of time for Pete Best. I think he gave them exactly what they needed at the time he was with them. That's the thing, most people, everybody in the Beatles story plays their part and plays their part in the way that they're supposed to play their part.
Yeah.
It's because, yeah, it is like the grand narrative of pop groups. So I have a lot of time for Pete Best's contribution as well, even though Ringo was destined to be the Beatle, really. Yeah. Like that bit that George says in the anthology where it was like he just came into the film at that point.
Yes, yeah.
I think that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, yeah, obviously it could have been done a little bit better, but...
It would have been a B-movie. But there was people people who saw Pete at the Cavern saying a lot of the time he would just stick on the bass drum and say boom, 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 four, four, which is... dance music, basically. So you can imagine live, they must have sounded completely different. So amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think we've got any live recordings with Pete, only studio recordings.
Oh, yeah, because even the Star Club is when Ringo had joined, wasn't it? Yeah. I would love to have listened to them at Hamburg. That would have been quite amazing. But at the same time, I love that Star Club record because Ringo's got swing, man. He's just so good. Like, he can just loosen things up and do different rhythms and take it into different spaces. And we'll come on to my praise of Ringo later on. But I have a lot. I've got a lot to say about my love for Ringo.
Next, we come on to the Beatles' third single, From Me to You.
From Me to You is always that interesting single because, you know, everybody, you know, the sort of totems of Please Please Me and She Loves You, you know, Please Me is always sort of heralded as a, like, the breakthrough song for them when George Martin finally got it and said, this is your first number one, fellas, and you know, She Loves You is the thing that, you know... launched Beatlemania. And From Me to You is always that one that sort of gets forgotten about and gets thought of as a single that doesn't really matter, but it was their actual first number one because the charts were done differently in those days, weren't they? And so From Me to You was the first one that was number one in all the charts, so was therefore number one. And it's a lovely song, and there's still that formula that was part of Love Me Do, the progression of Love Me Do, Please Please Me, From Me to You. Like, you could still hear the voices of EMI saying, more of the same, lads. And they're like, it has to have a little bit of harmonica and all that kind of thing just to keep to this formula. This formula's working. Because at that time, the Beatles were still sort of, they hadn't conquered the studio and EMI yet to sort of say, listen to us, we're the musicians and follow our instincts. But I love the way that Paul talks about it. I mean, I know he always gets accused of saying the same stories over and over again, but I can still listen to him say the old stories over and over again, and he always goes on about the chord that goes into
I got arms at long toe.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true, you know, like, again, that's like one of those little things that the Beatles did that sort of made pop music just take that little step forward.
Yes,
because you know, there was always the, this is how pop music should go, and this is the chords that you should use, and this is the structure of the songs, and the Beatles were always just tweaking it that little bit, and it always and the fact, like, you know, they said right at the beginning that they were sitting on a mass of songs that they'd written since, you know, the 50s, which wasn't really the case. They were sort of more sitting on a lot of fragments rather than a lot of completed songs. But, like, from Me to You onwards, it's like they're just, their motor just starts running in a way that's quite unfathomable nowadays. Like, the fact that they just wrote this song on a bus on the Helen Shapiro tour, and just, like, you know, of an evening, they just sit together and bash it out, and and then it goes to number one, and then they realise this is what we've got to do now. This is how we're going to work.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, like nowadays, folk take years and years and years to make an album, and the Beatles were releasing squillions of singles and two albums a year while they were on tour, while they were doing television appearances galore, radio appearances galore. I mean, it's just, it's kind of miraculous.
Oh, their diaries, frenetic to say the least. But again, when you're saying about the harmonica, because people listen, you know, at the time, they would have thought the harmonica was the fifth Beatle instrument at that point. The first three singles, it's like their sound. And then from then on, they kind of forget all about it, really. There's a few tracks here and there.
Well, I know. There's periods where, or moments where they do, like, sort of have an instrument and they're like, let's use that for these couple of songs. Well, we'll put... and the harmonica was definitely one of their earlier... And I think it's great. Like, the harmonica on Love Me Do is brilliant. Like, I think that, I'd probably say the harmonica on Love Me Do is more interesting than the harmonica that's on From Me to You. From Me to You, it does sound a little bit perfunctory in a way that it doesn't on Love Me Do. But it's got the falsetto that they were just about to, you know, really rip into with the next single. And I like the fact that from the very beginning, when they did start writing their songs, Paul always says, oh, it was all about the fans, Me to You, I Love You, blah, blah, blah. But that's a great... I've always considered that a brilliant thing about the Beatles. Mm. I've always considered the fact that they had such a strong relationship with their fans, even before Beatlemania, even before they were famous, even, you know, with the Cavern, you know, like, they would get... And when they were over in Hamburg, they would, like, the girls from the Cavern would write them letters, and, you know, they had such a relationship with the fans who would, you know, give them their requests and things like that. And it's like they were unashamed about appealing to girls. It wasn't something that, you know, a lot of boy bands get a little bit embarrassed about that now, whereas the Beatles knew.
Oh, they knew.
How important. they absolutely knew that the girls know, man. The girls know. And when they know, they really know. So, that's one of my big plus points for the Beatles, is that they were unashamed about that relationship, and it didn't embarrass them, and they wanted to appeal to them. And it wasn't cynical. Like, maybe they probably had the odd cynical comment, particularly maybe later in the later Beatlemania phase, when, like, you know, when Beatlemania was getting scary rather than enjoyable. Mm. They were probably like, whoa. But at the beginning, they were absolutely excited to appeal to the girls and to have them scream back and to get that reaction from them.
Yeah.
And they wanted to get it. And I really like that. They knew so much how important it was. Like, Kenny Lynch on that Helen Shapiro show was always like, oh, you can't do that in a song. They wouldn't like that. Mm. And they were like, it'll work. And it did. And that's why the Beatles are the Beatles. I mean, I know. I like Kenny Lynch is groovy too. He was, but the Beatles knew. And they went for it, and I like that.
Yeah. One thing I love about this, we can see exactly what they looked like when they were recording this, because it's today that they shot the Please Please Me album cover with Angus McBee.
Is that right?
So that is what they look like.
Yeah. That cover always makes me smile because Ringo's still got his quiff in it.
Yeah.
Which is weird because, you know, like the story always goes is that when he was asked to join, they were just like, shave your beard, cut your hair and put it forward. But then in that picture, he's still got his quiff. Yeah.
I think it's half and half. I think he's tried to comb it down and it's just boing. You know?
All that gel, just muscle memory in the hair.
Next, track three, Thank You Girl. This is the B-side From Me to You.
Yeah, and it was going to be the A-side as well. Like they wrote this before From Me to You, and then when they recorded them, they decided that From Me to You was the chosen A-side, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah.
Again, Thank You Girl has like the mouth organ and all that kind of thing, but there's a little bit of more daring in Thank You Girl, particularly the drumming. Like Ringo's drumming probably is the best thing about the song, particularly at the end.
Yeah.
You know, he always says that he wasn't really like a drummer for doing fills and all that kind of stuff, but that bit at the end of Thank You Girl, he is a brilliant way to end song.
Yeah.
And so there's just, it sounds a little different to what had gone on before. So I wonder if it was a cautionary thing, putting Thank You Girl as the B-side and From Me to You as the A-side, that maybe From Me to You was considered the safer bet.
Hmm.
I'm not sure. I think I do prefer From Me to You to Thank You Girl overall, though, even with Ringo swinging drums. Yeah.
At this point, you could say they were at risk of becoming formulaic, primarily because of the harmonica.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if they deliberately stopped using it. But again, harmonica would have been a lot of George Martin's idea, I think, because John wouldn't have physically been able to do these things live.
Yeah, because going back to Love Me Do, it was John that used to sing the Love Me Do bit. Like, so it was always just Love Me Blow.
Yeah.
I can't believe it took George Martin to say, you know, we need to have somebody else singing that.
Yeah, surely it would have been obvious.
The other thing that I like about Thank You Girl is they do sing it a little differently to the way that they sang From Me to You and particularly Please Please Me, where they kind of let rip a little bit on Please Please Me in a way that they don't on From Me to You. And you can hear a sort of more Buddy Holly influence and that sort of you, like that and the way they that sort of mannered way that they sing Yeah rather than,
yeah,
well, the next song that we're coming up to. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say. She said she loved you, and you know that can't be bad. Yes, she loved you, and you know you should be glad.
Next you have She Loves You.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, oh. What is there to say about this song? It's just, it's such an announcement of everything about the Beatles. And it's interesting that in this song, the harmonica is ditched. But everything else about it just signifies we are here. You know that bit in Let It Be where they're doing that guitar bit on I've Got a Feeling, and then Paul McCartney says, good morning, because they finally got it the way that he wants it. She Loves You is that. It's that good morning moment where it's joy in 2 minutes, it's excitement in 2 minutes, it's everything that you want from a band's sort of just, they've elbowed their way in now. The She Loves You is them elbowing their way in and just planting themselves in the firmament. And I cannot get enough of She Loves You. It's absolutely one of my favourite songs. And I would have loved to have been at the session as well, just because you can hear the excitement in the song as well. The energy is totally palpable, but it feels live. And even like the yeah, yeah, yes, it's like, it sounds as if there's a million people singing the yeah, yeah, yes, but there isn't.
It does, yeah.
So that's why it's like, it is, it's like a clarion call. It's like, this is where we're going, people. And the whole world followed, and no wonder. Just everything about the from the opening drum fill to that last amazing harmony, it's just goose pimple stuff. Absolutely.
It's got a sort of,
I love it,
almost operatic drama to it.
Yeah.
That much intensity, yeah. I think.
And particularly with the falsetto and the build up and and all that, it's like they absolutely know what they're doing with this song.
The tension at the end and you know you should.
Yeah.
You can only imagine the fans hearing that live.
Oh, I know. It's just no wonder that they were peeing themselves and screaming like mad. I think I might have... Would I have been a screamer? I don't know if I would have been a... Maybe I might have been a screamer.
It's hard to tell, isn't it? I reckon I would.
Yeah. and it went to number one twice as well.
It did.
Like, it had two stints.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. And it was knocked off by I Wanna Hold Your Hand as well.
Oh, well, they were just... Cause, so, I mean, their albums as well, wasn't it? Please Please Me was number one.
Yeah.
And then taken over by With the Beatles. Up to about 67, pretty well, it was the Beatles and the Stones who only had number one albums in the 60s,
yeah,
with a few exceptions. But I think that's pretty well...
Maybe like The Sound of Music.
That was in
there,
yeah.
The Sound of Music soundtrack might have been in there.
Yeah. And that was it.
I can't think of... Folk would have done like song collections, but... You know, you get a sense of albumness with the Beatles from quite early on, and probably the Stones as well.
Yeah, I guess because there was Please Please Me as an album cover is kind of from the previous generation of album covers rather than looking that forward. Because ostensibly David Hepworth was on before saying, you know, albums were like getting an annual for Christmas if you didn't have that much money, and it was the singles that were everything. So I think for them to make... To have that cover really gave it an identity, apart from the songs themselves, but created the concept of an album, perhaps. And the Stones obviously copied that, as they did.
They copied a lot, didn't they? I love the Stones, but you know.
Yeah.
I always find it a mind-blowing fact, too, that that... She Loves You was the best-selling song until Mullachintyre.
Yeah. Well, demand for the single, EMI had to press over 250,000 copies in the 4 weeks before it was officially released.
Uh-huh.
So the excitement was already there.
Yeah.
And then to be rewarded with this.
Yeah. This is the song that when Beatlemania went crazy. And, you know, this was probably around the time with the London Palladium and...
Yeah.
And all that kind of thing as well, where just we were all waking up to a different time now. It was like, we are here, and what are you going to do about it? We're going to lap it up. That's what we're going to do. And it also, like, the, you know, a lot of people talk about the last harmony, which is a beautiful, beautiful sound. And that was George's idea, considering, you know, Lennon McCartney wrote the song, but it was his idea to do that last, harmony. And George Martin seemingly was like, nah, that's a bit cheesy. And George was like, no, it'll work. And George Harrison was right. George Harrison is the secret weapon of...
Building relationships and getting extra notes in chords. George is the man.
Yeah, he is. He absolutely is. Because, you know, there's not a George song on the Past Masters Volume 1. So, I want to say how much I love George. it's in his understanding of harmony that it is one of the secret weapons. I think he probably understood harmony a lot more than John did, for example. Even though John would write the songs, when it came to sort of like putting the songs together, it was quite a very much collaborative thing. And like you hear it in that outtake that's on YouTube of them doing Think for Yourself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're chatting away. I listen to that quite regularly just because I love it. And you can, and George and Paul have got the harmony down, like they're just like,
yeah,
you've got time to rectify. And George is, John is totally struggling with it, which sort of hints at, you know, when it comes to the musicality aspect of the Beatles,
yeah,
I think George's role is obviously totally underplayed, and his additions to how they should arrange, like the arrangements and all that kind of thing, he was absolutely such a part of that.
Doing a third part harmony is really difficult, especially if you've got Everly Brothers style two part harmonies, then to squeeze
in the craziest he always does the craziest harmonies where you're just like, what is he actually singing? I don't understand, like what is that? Because it's not a melody in a way. It's just it's to try and pull out George's harmony is always the hardest thing to do.
Somebody on YouTube put the individual vocals of Eleanor Rigby, the look at all the lonely people. They sound amazing, but you would have thought they would go up and down together. This is my musical technical knowledge here. Do the bit where it goes up.
Musical or technical,
do the bit where it goes down. But they don't. They kind of interweave where you really don't expect them to, and it's really surprising to hear how they did it.
Ah, look at all the lonely people. Ah, look at all the lonely people. Ah, look at all the lonely people.
When you hear their harmonies, that's what you think all the time. And because George isn't known for his singing voice, like he's not the strongest singer in the same way that Paul is, for example, but the way that he can use his voice in harmony and just totally meld it in to whoever he's harmonising with, it stuns me often.
He's the perfect third part harmony because his voice is almost part Paul, part John. He's got a bit of a John twang, but it's smooth as Paul's.
I don't know how he does it, but he does it every time. He's I love him.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Many times before, it's not like me to pretend, but I'll get you in the end. Yes, I will, I'll get you in the end. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Track 5, I'll Get You. This is the B-side of She Loves You.
This one's always, it's a little bit of a downer, I'll Get You, coming off the back of She Loves You. Which is a wee shame, because it's not a bad song. And again, in a weird way, it sort of falls back to what they had been doing beforehand with the harmonica and the sort of formula and the way that they threw out the window with She Loves You.
Yeah.
But I still really like it, and I love the hand claps. I love how the Beatles do lots of hand claps in their songs. I'm a bit of a sucker for a hand clap in a song. But even saying that there's a certain formula to it, there's all, again, with the Beatles, there's always these moments in Beatles songs where they just do something, and they do that in I'll Get You with that sort of weird note, whatever that note is, when in the pretend.
Yeah.
It's not like me to breathe. It's that. I mean, where did they come from?
Well, apparently, according to Paul, it was from All My Trials by Joan Baez.
Right, okay. Oh, well, right. Okay.
Hush, little baby, don't you cry. It's not like me to pretend.
Influences and the way that they use them. And again, with the bit where the song really lifts is the middle bit where George comes in to do the three-part harmony.
Swoops into the rescue. But it's as you were saying earlier, you know, their development, it's never more so than the first three or four singles.
Absolutely.
Such a leap each time.
I know, and if you don't know the story of music and the way that it sort of moved from, you know, rock and roll and the pack, like, into what it's now, it is, as I say, it's easy for people to take that for granted and to not appreciate how a simple chord change or a simple strange note that's not usually in a pop song but in a folk song then it becomes part of pop vocabulary, and that's what the Beatles did. That's, I think that's one of the reasons why they are what they are.
Jeff Lloyd was when he calls them magpies.
Yeah.
Because you would never, you would never, unless Paul had admitted, Joan Baez was a bit of influence for this. Doesn't really jump out at you.
No, but like, even if it's nicked from the song, it's not like, it's still, because they've twisted it in their own Beatle way, it's not plagiarism in a way that they were maybe guilty of later on.
Oh yeah, I tell you something, I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to hold your hand.
Next we come to a biggie, it's I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah, this is a totem song as well. I think it's more of a, it's a totem song because of, it was the song that introduced them to the American charts, rather than, I mean, I prefer She Loves You to I Want to Hold Your Hand. I don't think I Want to Hold Your Hand is a step up from She Loves You. I don't know, how do you feel?
Yeah, it's definitely got more American filter, but they're both so totemic, it's hard to, in hindsight, I suppose, as you'd heard She Loves You, you're thinking, how are the Beatles going to follow that? But, you know, it can never be as good as that. And then this comes out.
Yeah.
And for me, they're kind of equal, but perhaps this is more because it still builds on such a massive song, She Loves You.
Yeah.
It just blows my mind.
And it's a huge part of the Beatles' story as well, which gives it such its power too. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant song, and again, like, there's all these brilliant moments where you're just like, they're doing that, like, just the thought processes behind it, you know, like the first cymbal crash and then the second cymbal crash and the third cymbal crash at the intro riff, and just the way it builds up. And I mean, where they came up with that falsetto harmony that goes into the chorus as well, I mean, that is, it's every time I hear it, even now, I'm just like, what is that sound? Yeah, yeah. Was that nicked from Joan Baez? It's amazing. And because I love She Loves You so much, I always think to myself, why didn't the Americans get it then? There's a little bit of a part of me that's kind of like, come on, Americans. Why didn't you get on board with She Loves You like us, like the rest of us?
Yeah, I think a lot of that was distribution, wasn't it? Because they,
yeah,
when they're in the top, when they had the top five singles, I think they're on three different record labels.
Yeah, was She Loves You not? It wasn't Capitol,
it was
wasn't
Swan.
It? It was, yeah, because Capitol were like, nah, it's not good enough yet.
Yeah,
like, it blows my mind to hear when George Martin talks about how they sent these over to Capitol, and Capitol were just like, nah, this is rubbish. And you're just like, oh my God, what are you listening to?
Mark Lewisohn was saying that about, you know, everybody goes on about Dick Rowe at Decca turning them down, saying, you know, guitar bands and everything. Poor Dick, you know, he didn't know any better. And it's, you know, it's not the greatest demo in the world.
I feel a little bit sorry for them.
Yeah. But Mark was saying the people who should really be put to account were the record labels that turned them down after hearing She Loves You.
Yeah,
you
know. Totally. Capitol, come on. Because, you know, because as you say, with Dick Rowe, it wasn't the best demo. And plus, as somebody that's worked in the publishing world, where you have to reject books and things and all that, like, and sometimes there are books that are fine, but they don't blow your mind, and you have to find something to say that justifies your rejection. So sometimes I think that maybe he just made a little bit of a there was an element of that in the rejection. He was like, it's all right, but it's not blow my mind, but I can't, so I'll just say guitar bands are going out even though I have no idea.
No, definitely.
But I'm glad they were, like, I'm glad they never got to Decca, because George Martin was just the best thing that happens to them, really.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not convinced that any other producer would have got them in the same way that he did.
No. Well, interesting you say that this was the first time they recorded on a four track.
Oh, was it this one?
Really,
oh,
pointing.
So I Want to Hold Your,
to the future.
Oh my God. So She Loves You probably has more, does have more of a live feel than.
Yeah.
How did they layer all that up with just two or three tracks? That kind of astounding.
No, what you heard was pretty well what was happening in the studio before that. And I think you can hear it on the stereo because the claps.
Claps again. Yeah. I've seen pictures of them all round a microphone clapping, and it just makes me smile, the thought of them all round a microphone clapping.
So yeah, already almost a studio band.
Yeah, and this song as well, you know, everybody uses this song or used this song as a sort of Beatles versus Stones thing, because they were like, oh, the Beatles just want to hold your hand. And you're just like, if you can't hear the sexiness in this song, then you're just not listening. Yeah. You're really not listening. You know, that middle eight as well, with the "when I touch you, I feel happy inside," like all to the "I can't hide" bit. The momentum to the "I can't hide" and the sort of the words, the sort of ambiguous words, the lyrics of it, you're just like, they absolutely are not just talking about holding your hand. Yeah, and I also, the other thing that I love about this song is the use of the word "something." Because a lot of the time the Beatles did write songs, and they were guilty of, like, using love song cliches like diamond rings and all that kind of stuff. But they also did a lot in their love songs where love and desire or whatever, it was an unexplainable thing. It was something that they couldn't quite put their finger on. And the word "something" in that suggests that as well. And with George's song "something" as well, yeah. You know, like... And that's the unexplainable nature of love and desire. That pleases me more than if you've got the words down pat by using the words that are normally used in love songs.
Yeah, something not quite tangible.
Yeah, and it shows that even in the early days, their lyrics had a little bit something more to them than they're probably giving credit for as well. That boy took my love.
And next we come to the B-side, "This Boy."
Oh, "This Boy" is just so, so beautiful. It's another one of my favourites. Again, because it just shows you another side of the Beatles, and it really encapsulates all their influences. Like, you can hear Smokey Robinson, you can hear doo-wop, you can hear girl groups, you can hear all those things that fed into the Beatles sound. And obviously, again, the harmonies are absolutely amazing. I used to sing this with my friend and my sister, and I sang the John bit and my sister sang the Paul bit. It was always my friend Linda, who is musical. She's a music teacher now, and she understands the language of music in a way that I'm quite in awe of. Like, she can hear everything. And so she, with the three-part harmony ones, she always sang the George bits because
we
can't hear what he's... Because she could just hear what George was doing and replicate that. And I always found that amazing. But again, it's what we were saying about George and his amazingness. And Paul and George's voices together as well. Like in the middle bit where John really lets rip and they're doing the ahs in the background. Like, everybody always bangs on about Paul and John's voices together. But I think Paul and George's voices together are... I think I might even prefer Paul and George's voices together than Paul and John. Just because, again, that the way they meld into each other...
Mm.
Because John is quite a singular singer. He's like, he's got a voice. I mean, he does have adaptability depending on what song he's singing, but there's something very singular in John's voice where Paul can do a million squillion things with his voice, and George just knows how to get into that pocket of the harmony. So I just think their harmonies together are always really, really special. I always think that John really lucked out with his backing singers. They were the best at the oohs and the bop bop shoe bops.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of doo wop in this. I mean, John said it was his attempt at writing a Smokey Robinson song.
Yeah.
And
you could totally hear Smokey doing this song as well.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Smokey doing that middle A bit? Oh my God, it would be magic. Yeah. And again, there was little moments as well that, like, that just lifts a song. And this boy, the whole song's great, but like just in the fade out of this boy where Paul slightly changes his harmony, where he goes a little bit higher, where he goes, "This boy." Yeah. And that's in the fade out, but it's just that little thing, that little detail that just makes your heart beat a little bit faster.
There's a lovely outtake of this where they're messing up the lyrics and they keep one singing "this boy" and one singing "that boy."
Oh, John did that all the time. "This boy." "This boy." "Oh, come on, come to me. Do it with the first time.
So the next two tracks are "Komm gib mir deine Hand" and "Sie liebt dich." Not in the UK, but the only time we had a Lennon McCartney Nicholas Helmer songwriting credit due to the translation.
So is that considered a Northern song then? Is that part of the Northern song catalogue?
Yeah, in the UK it was Lennon McCartney.
Right.
But in abroad they did issue it under that credit.
Right, okay. To be honest, if I'm truthful, when I was younger, when I used to play like the Past Masters as an album, I would fast forward to the to the start of side two, and I was just starting. I mean, you can hear that it was something that they were asked to do and they were made to do.
Yeah,
like they just don't sing either of these songs with the same kind of abandon as they do "She Loves You" and "I Want to Hold Your Hand." You know, it was a contractual thing, wasn't it? The record company wanted them to do it.
Yeah, they were advised it would be for their benefit if they did do it.
Do you know how well it did in Germany? Because it was considered like, oh, they would sell more records in Germany if they did a German version.
It hit number one in West Germany.
Oh, really? Oh, brilliant. Oh, that's good then.
Yeah. What a relief.
You know, they were right, yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, because they recorded it. They didn't record this in Abbey Road. They did this when they were in Paris.
That's it, yeah. Yeah.
And again, I wonder if that contributes to the fact that it doesn't sound as beatily as it should.
I think so.
Because just before they headed off to America and took the world by storm.
They did.
Have you ever seen Jojo Rabbit? Have you ever seen the use of...
No, I've heard about it. Yeah. It's supposed to be amazing.
I only watched Jojo Rabbit for the first time this year, actually. It was fairly recently that I watched it, and I didn't know anything about the film. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know anything. Yeah. I just knew it was a film that that a lot of people were saying was a brilliant film, and I think it won a couple of Oscars. I'm not sure.
I think so,
can't remember. But so I watched it, and then "Komm gib mir deine Hand" came on. And just the opening credits, it's done so brilliantly. It's a very, very subversive
yes, I've heard.
Way of talking about the Nazis.
Yeah.
And the use of the song is done really, really, I was laughing my head off when I saw it. I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe they've done this. But it totally made sense for the film. And in a way, I was kind of like, Who explained to Apple or whoever, like, this is how we're going to use the song.
Yeah.
We're going to use this song in a film about Nazis. How do you feel about that? Because, you know, Apple are...
Oh, blimey, yeah.
They're not ones for chucking Beatles songs at adverts and all that kind of thing. But it does work really well. I'm going to tell it!
Oh! Next, we have the title track from the EP Long Tall Sally.
Yes. After She Loves You, I think this is the massive highlight of Past Masters Volume 1. I've listened to the song about a million times this week. Because I just can't get over it. There's loads of sessions that I would have loved to have been there to see them recording it, but I think I really would have loved to have been in this session to see them recording Long Tall Sally. Just, you know, because everybody bangs on about how Twist and Shout was done in one take, but this was done in one take as well.
Yeah.
And, I love Paul McCartney doing Little Richard. I love Little Richard. Like, of all the sort of... of all the pioneer rock and rollers, I think Little Richard is my favourite, and I love Paul's take on Little Richard songs as well.
Mm.
But this performance, it's often difficult to recreate in a studio the same kind of energy that you would as a live, but they absolutely do that in this recording. You know, there was such frenzy and abandon and screaming and the way that it just keeps building and building momentum, just the way they play with the rhythm of the song, and it just builds and builds and builds and builds, and it just doesn't let up until the end. I can't quite get over this version of Long Tall Sally. It's so good. And the other thing I've been doing is I've been watching on YouTube lots of live performances of them doing Long Tall Sally as well, just to see them doing it live. Like, Ringo's drumming is so brilliant.
Mm.
That last bit where they're doing the last Gonna Have Some Fun Tonight bit, and I don't know what he's doing. It's like he's just doing fill after fill after fill after fill after fill. And when you watch footage of them doing it, and Ringo's banging away at this, and at the end when he goes, oh, some fun, and hi, and in the end, Ringo always looks so exhausted.
Yeah, he does, yeah. His hands are aren't they, when you see the footage?
I know. It's just amazing. I absolutely love it. And, I can never get enough of Macca doing Little Richard. I remember, like, even solo Macca, like, there's footage of them, I think it's footage of Wings rehearsals in the 70s.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's singing Lucille.
Yeah.
Oh, that's one of my favourite bits of footage of Paul as well. It's just so sexy. I love the Beatles screaming. I love it. I love all of them screaming.
Yeah.
They're so good at screaming. And also the way Paul does that, yeah, yeah, like the just the build up of the yes,
yeah.
And the way they get, it's just excitement. It's just utter excitement. And it's no wonder that they continue to have this in their live shows, even till the very end. This is that was the last song that they played at Candlestick Park.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
you think how long they've been playing it? They've been doing it back in the cavern.
Yeah. They're probably just like, to have that in the bag as a possible end of the show,
yeah.
It's like, so it's Old Faithful.
Yeah.
But it is such a screamer that there's no wonder that they finished so many gigs with it. I mean, the fact that Paul did all these, like, the Beatles' touring schedule was so mental, and that Paul would do that every day, because he really screams it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the Beatles wear ones for, like, lozenges and honey drinks and stuff before,
Zoops,
before shows or anything. Yeah. But I find it amazing that he can still talk, let alone sing, in his 80s.
Yeah.
Oh, he's not quite 80 yet, is he?
Well, that's it. You think now people are saying about his voice, but that is why. He was doing this.
He's earned it, man. Yeah, he's really earned his old man voice.
Yeah, and I think also George's guitar solo is perfection on this.
Yeah,
because every time, I think I've said it before, but every time after he does the
love that bit.
At the end of each one, he never does the same solo on any recordings. He always does, but the one he does on here is perfect.
Yeah, everything just coalesced
in
such an amazing way in this one take of this song. It could be like the best they've ever played it.
Yeah.
But that is the, like, a lot of people give, particularly Georgie's early guitar solos, they give them, like, they sort of say, oh. But I love them. I love their simplicity. I love the way they sound, as if they're sort of, all the notes are sort of falling into each other rather than, like, you know, like really crystal clear and all. I love that messiness of it. But I also love it when he really nails one, like the footage of the Royal Variety performance, where when they're doing Till There Was You.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see in his face, he's like, oh, it's the Till There Was You solo, and you can see him really concentrating doing it. And then when he does that final tring of the solo, he has this little smile on his face, like, nailed that, yes!
It does, yeah. That's a really tricky solo.
It is a tricky solo. And and it was, you know, it was a big occasion for them as well. And he did it brilliantly. But just that wee smile that he gives to himself afterwards. Yeah. You're just like, oh, George.
I call your name, but you're not there. Was I to blame for being you've been gone? I never weep at night. I can't go on.
Next we have another song from the Long Tall Sally EP, I Call Your Name. Very early composition.
Yeah, I didn't realise that it was a song that they had written like a wee while back. I assumed that it had been written at the time they recorded it, but no, it was an early song. And I know that, like, John has a habit of sort of making throwaway comments about a lot of the songs that he wrote, particularly his early songs. They were like, oh, hack stuff, that was nothing, blah. And I know he says that about this song. I really like this song. I know a lot of people think it's a bit meh, but I really like it. I think it's quite amazing to write a song about the desperation of loneliness and love in such a cheerful manner.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of sugar. There's a lot of sugar on that bitter lyric to it.
Yeah. Lyrically, this could be off Plastic Ono Band.
It could, yeah, it totally could. Well, actually, no, wait, or imagine in a call your name in the middle of
it. Yeah. That's it. It's another song like Girl, where he was writing about Yoko and he didn't even know it yet.
Yeah.
I call your name, but you're not there. Oh, Yoko.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's funny that he returns to tropes, but yeah, I mean, I understand why John, or I don't understand why John does that. Like, sometimes I just want to shake him and say, for God's sake, you did brilliant things.
I know. Yeah.
Stop doing down your work, man. But he was quite a big one for self-loathing and doing down things, which always makes me sad. But I really like the swing of it. I like the cowbell. And I think this was probably recorded similarly around about the same time as Hard Day's Night.
Yes, yeah.
Because Hard Day's Night's quite big on the cowbell as well.
Yeah.
So like the harmonica earlier on, I think the cowbell became like a little percussion instrument of choice in 1964. But I do like a cowbell. And I like the way the rhythm changes into a sort of ska-ish type thing in the middle of it as well. And it's done seamlessly too. Like, there's a couple of other Beatles songs where it does change tempo and it's not as seamless, but this one it is. And yeah, I'll have a lot of time for this one.
Ringo did a cover of this for the John Lennon tribute special.
Oh, I've not seen that.
It's a very Jeff Lynne. You can, without hearing it, think Ringo produced by Jeff Lynne singing this song. That's all you need to know.
Well, yeah, that's a sound that would be recognised. I mean, yeah, I have a lot of respect for Jeff Lynne, but I'm not a huge fan of ELO and that particular sound. I think he's brilliant and I love him and I'm glad he exists and all that. But I'm not a huge fan. Even though I do like Cloud Nine and the Traveling Wilburys, but there's something about the Jeff Lynne sound that doesn't quite totally make me get as excited as
but you like Real Love.
Other music does. I prefer Real Love to Free as a Bird. Yeah, I kind of do wish that George Martin had produced both Free as a Bird and Real Love. I mean, as I say, I think Jeff Lynne's a really great, great guy and a great musician, but there's part of me that was just like, George, just go and let George Martin do it.
There was a lot of politics going on at the time within the band,
yeah,
wasn't there?
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It would be nice if they could have got Jeff to do the technical bit, get it all synced up, and then give it to George Martin.
Yeah. You know, I've talked about how much I love George a lot today, but that Thrawn character that he has, and the way you're just like, George, this isn't the important bit. This isn't the important... He could hold a grudge, that guy.
He could, yes, he could. Well, come on, pretty baby, won't you walk with me? Come on, pretty baby, won't you talk with me? Come on, pretty baby, give me one more chance. Try to save our romance, slow down. Baby, now you're moving way too fast. If you want love to last. Next, it's the third track from the Long Tall Sally EP, Larry Williams' Slow Down.
Yeah, now I really like the Beatles covers of Larry Williams' songs, but this one is my least favourite one. Dizzy Miss Lizzy and Bad Boy, which we'll come to, are the ones that I much, much more prefer, because there's, as I say, there's more of a... See, I'm using the word abandon quite a lot, but you need that for rock and roll, you know, that just sort of letting yourself go and absolutely going for it. Whereas Slow Down, bizarrely, I don't know why, is there's a sort of constrained quality to it. It's not as free as Dizzy Miss Lizzy or Bad Boy. By the end of it, it's loosened up. Like the sort of the last verse where it starts up with the long well, like you're sort of like, yeah, you're getting there, John, and it ends really well. But it takes a wee while for him to get there than he normally does, which is I find quite interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I read that because I looked out my Mark Lewisohn complete chronicle book with the recording sessions. I looked up and I saw that the session with Slow Down and Matchbox, what we'll come to next, was on the same day, and it was done after a holiday period. So they'd been on holiday, and this was like the first session after being on holiday, which I find quite interesting that they weren't, it was like they're not quite in the zone yet.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely got that, you know, post-holiday feel, that Monday back at work.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like when they can let themselves go more easily when they're being overworked and like filling it, like doing in as many things as possible. But just when they're feeling relaxed, they're not quite hitting the mark. And this, I think Carl Perkins was at this
So they say.
Yeah, well.
So they say.
All right. Oh, is he not?
You think how many people visited that studio?
I know. When you see pictures of them working in the studio, there's always folk dotted about that you don't know. Like you expect to see like sort of Mal and George Martin and Neil and all that kind of thing, but there's always like folk that you have no idea who they are dotted about in the background when the Beatles were recording. You're kind of like. Again, that makes it so amazing that so much chaos and craziness was around them, but they could focus themselves into making the music.
Yeah.
I mean, I doubt that's how recording sessions work nowadays with folk coming in and out the room and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I'm guessing now it's all done by email. Unfortunately. I think for me, for this, there's not that much effort. I mean, John's fluffing the lyrics and then they're double tracking his lyrics. And he's got different lyrics on each recording.
Yeah, because he said in the bit where he says, now you've got a boyfriend.
Yeah.
But in the other double track, he says girlfriend. Yeah. so you've got girl and boyfriend at the same time, which I quite like, actually. I think, I don't know. I mean, it probably was him just forgetting, but I quite like the notion that it might be a little bit of subversiveness as well. Because he had Foreman doing that, you know, with the Revolution, you know, count me out, count
absolutely,
me in.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he was just in fluffing his lyrics.
I think I said, I'm sitting here watching Matchbox holding my clothes. I said, I'm sitting here wondering, Matchbox holding my clothes. I ain't got no matches, but I sure got a long way to go.
And then the final track from Long Tall Sally it's Ringo's Matchbox, another Carl Perkins song.
Yeah, this session probably wasn't their best one, because Ringo doesn't suit being double-tracked at all.
No, definitely not.
It's just that there's such a mismatch with the vocal in this. I would like to say something that might get me laughed out of town, but I actually think that Ringo is an underrated singer. I don't think Matchbox is the song to advertise that. But when he cooks, he really does cook. And I think with Ringo, if he had a little bit more confidence and belief in himself, he probably could have been a much better singer than he thought he was. Like, when he does let it rip, like in Boys, for example, you don't hear a self-consciousness in Boys that you do in later Ringo songs with the Beatles, which I always find quite interesting. I love the way he absolutely screams Boys. Boys is kind of like, you know, Long Tall Sally. She loved, like, it's just excitement in a song. Because it's all of them screaming. I love them all. I love the way they all scream during the guitar solo and all that. It's like they can't help themselves. Yeah. I love it. And you know, like in slow songs, he's got a little bit of vibrato, and like he's got skills, but I think like his self consciousness was probably an enemy to his singing. Like he wouldn't trust himself to like sing the note in the fullness of the note, because he would just constrain himself. But like for some of the songs, like on Boku of Blues, he gets the emotion out of the song, and he's got different vocal styles too, depending on the song too, which shows a little bit of diversity in his singing. And, you know, I'm not saying that Ringo's the best singer in the world. I'm not, totally not. He's limited. But, in his limits, he can do more than he thinks he can.
I think in the Beatles, it almost sounds like he's a kid on a bike. The others are his stabiliser. And then when they split up, he does sing more confidently. It's sort of like he's had the training from the best singers at the time.
And on the Ringo album as well.
Yeah.
The way he shouts out that, "I'm the greatest and you better believe it, baby." Yeah. Like, he just totally goes for it. I love it. Yeah. And I wish he'd trusted himself more, because I think he probably, as I say, he was better than he thought he was. He's got such an interesting voice as well. Like, it's just not usual. I think that's a good thing, though. To be able to cover 5 million octaves and all those kind of things, those are amazing skills. But when you've got limited range, but you know how to use that limited range, that's an amazing thing too in vocalists. You know, like, you know, Bob Dylan, you can't exactly say he's
he's the most Pavarotti
singer, but no, but you know, he's the charisma in his voice in so many different songs. Yeah, like I have a lot of time for. I kind of wish that I'd been there as a cheerleader, saying, "No, Ringo, come on!" And also, like I really dislike the narrative that Ringo was the lucky man, the guy that was tagging along. No. I hate it. I hate it so much. It's just nonsense, and because it's not just that he was an amazing drummer. He completely fitted in from the very beginning, and he would always have fitted in with the Beatles because. The thing that makes the Beatles what they were as well is not just their musicianship, it's them too. It's them as people, and the way that they looked at the world, and looked at the world creatively and a little bit more left field and restlessly, and never wanted to repeat themselves, and ever curious, ever seeking out the new and everything. And Ringo had that just as much as the rest of them did. His sensibilities were completely matched the other three. So he's not just like this tag-along gang member. He was totally there for a reason. Like, his humour and, like, just the way he thinks about the world and expresses his thoughts about the world as well. And even before the Beatles, you know, like, he wanted to go to America to be a cowboy, and he left Rory Storm and went to Hamburg before, and then got back to Rostrum because he was getting restless with Rory Storm. He was kind of like, they're doing all that they can do, and I want to do something else. And he was always looking for that better band, that better gig, that sort of way out of the life that he grew up with, in very much the same way that John, Paul and George did. And so it just annoys me that folk kind of put Ringo in this box as this meat and potatoes guy that lucked out, which is just nonsense. I love Ringo!
Baby's good to me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine.
Next, we have I Feel Fine.
I Feel Fine, another kind of totemic song because of the use of feedback as well. I mean, John claims that it was the first ever use of feedback on recorded music. Is that true? I mean, could it have been done before?
I think he's probably right. I can't think of any more.
Yeah, and it's done so well. This is the thing about the Beatles with these sort of accidents. Is that it's done so well as well. Like, it doesn't feel out of place in a pop song. It feels just right for the start of that song. And, like, you know, like, a lot of folk use feedback. And, well, we won't talk about Lou Reed.
Oh, plenty, yeah.
But you're like, yeah, Lou Reed, that's a bit too much. Just learn from the Beatles. Do it at the beginning of a song, that's it.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, you've got this and it's all too much. How they develop the same.
Yeah, and also, at the very end of that feedback, there's also a whisper as well, which I've never been able to quite work out what's being said and who is it. Yeah. It's good that there's still mysteries to be solved.
Yes, yeah.
with the Beatles though, so you know somebody can do that for us. Yeah. But it's a great song anyway. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant pop song. I know that the riff was a reworked version of the Bobby Parker song, What's Your Step, which is also a brilliant, brilliant song as well.
Yeah, it's a bit of Day Tripper in that as well, isn't it?
Ah, right, yeah. The drumming is brilliant too, that sort of what I'd say element to it as well, which is, it kind of saddens me that we've not got a Beatles version of What I'd Say, because I know that they covered that song and that is one of my favourite songs of all time, and I would have loved to have been able to hear a Beatles version of What I'd Say. But yeah, it's great. Georgie's guitar is brilliant. It sounds like it's just swimming in and out. I don't know what it is. And again, Paul and George's harmonies in the background are brilliant. I love the footage of them doing this on the Shea Stadium gig. And they end it, but George, it's like George has forgotten where he is because he like carries on singing, fine. it just sounds so funny. Yeah. I don't know why, it really makes me laugh how fine sounds like fan.
Yeah.
With their Liverpudlian accents, I love it.
Yeah.
and the video as well with the gym equipment. Is it the gym? Is that the gym equipment video?
Yeah.
Ringo's on the exercise bike, and all the rest of them are standing, surrounded by weightlifting things. When you look back to a lot of 60s promos clips, you're just kind of like, where did they come up with that idea? Like, why have they got gym equipment around about them? It's so, like, the stage design in 60s pop shows always blow my mind. But yeah, no, I Feel Fine is, it's just swinging. I love it.
October the 18th, they recorded this. First of all, they recorded Kansas City, Hey, 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 Hey.
Ah,
then
right,
Mr. Moonlight, then this, and then I'll Follow the Sun.
I mean, four songs in one day.
They also finished off 8 days a week while they were doing that as well.
It's just insane. It's like, you just can't... Because not only are they four... Like, they've recorded four songs, but they recorded four brilliant songs, you know? Well, maybe Mr. Moon... Well, I have a bit of a soft spot for Mr. Moonlight, actually.
Yeah, it gets a lot of crap. I think it's all right.
It does. I think that the Hammond... Is it a Hammond organ in the middle?
Oh,
cruise
ship.
Laugh.
Yeah,
like to have made that choice. It just makes me laugh. I love, and you know, nobody. You can't fault the John's opening of it where he shouts out, "Mister." I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah,
but yeah, to record four brilliant songs in one day. I mean, and they did that all the time as well in the early years as well. Yeah. So this isn't even like a special day.
My love, don't give me presents. I know that she's no peasant. Only ever has to give me love forever and forever. My love, don't give me presents. Turn me on when I get lonely. People tell me that she's on.
Then we go to the B-side, She's a Woman. Talking about knocking up songs quickly, here's another one.
Yeah, I must admit, I do love this song. It does have the worst rhyming couplet in the world. You know, what was Paul thinking with presents and peasant?
Yeah.
But also, what was John, would have been shy to say, Paul, that's a shit lyric, you're going to have to change that. So it surprises me that it got through them all, to be honest. But even with that, I still love the song. Though I thought, like, my first hearing of this song was the Skritti Politti version in the 80s. So
they
I
did.
Thought,
yeah,
because that's the thing with, like, same with like Tiffany doing I Saw Her Standing There.
Oh yeah,
because that was before I knew like which songs were the Beatles and all that kind of thing. And so when I heard the Beatles doing them for the first time, I was like, oh, that's that song that Skritti Politti did, or that's that song that Tiffany did.
The same way like Pinky and Perky, that's how I just, you know, Yellow Submarine and things like that. That's the first time I heard them.
I'm a bit too young for Pinky and Perky.
Yeah, well, these were hand-me-downs, obviously.
But yeah, I do love She's a Woman. I like the spikiness of it. I like, and similar, like Taxman. I like that sort of, is it syncopated guitar? I really like that.
Yeah.
And again, it's Paul singing in his little Richard voice, which I always really love. Though I do think that they do it better live than the recorded version. Like, I've seen them do it live, like at the NME prize winner show or whatever, and I think it's much looser live than the recorded version. But I still love it.
Well, the day they recorded this, Ringo took his driving test and passed first time, you'd be pleased to know.
He passed first time. Well done, Ringo. Though, I mean, can you imagine the driving instructor? I've got a Beetle in my car.
Yeah, you ain't going to fail him, are you?
Like, yeah, you've passed, even though you've knocked that woman over.
But also, you've got a bit of Dylan influence on Turn Me On When I Get Lonely.
Yes. Well, see, because Paul, when Paul talks about Day in the Life, he always talks about when Paul, like, when they get to that Turn Me On phrase, and he was like, this is the first time that we're saying something that's in the culture, and you're just like, well, you say it and She's a Woman.
Yes. Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? And She's a Peasant. Oh, she's no peasant, actually. Yeah,
she's no
she's
peasant,
better than
she's
a peasant,
classy.
Yeah. That classy,
because she doesn't want presents.
Yeah. what a woman. She's what a compliment.
I like
as well.
His little I like his little cameo appearance and help as well in the scene where they blow them up in the army field.
But it's
because I'm a big fan of The Night Before as well. I think that's a great song, which is another Beatles song that doesn't normally get its due as well. People think it's a bit of a sort of pop throwaway, but I don't know. There's something about the sound of it and the melody of that song that really excites me.
Yeah.
So and again, because I watched the film Help before listening to the album Help, I didn't hear the song in its fullness.
Right. Yeah.
until later. So like the way, because it sort of gets disjointed with the bit with She's a Woman.
Mm.
So I always found that interesting. It's like, oh, right, okay.
Yeah. I think the live version they do at the Hollywood Bowl is astonishing on this. Because they kind of use the crowd as percussion almost.
And again, he does that where he says, yeah, 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 and he builds it. And you're just like, oh, my God, I can't take this, Paul.
Yeah. I think Samira Ahmed was on before saying, you know, they were, for teenage fans, they would have been so sexy, and it's things like that that are coming out every
now
and again.
Yeah, I do not judge those girls, but with their screams and their hair pulling and all that kind of thing, I totally get it. It's like, how could you not, you know? I'm going to watch the Hollywood Bowl clips on YouTube straight after we've chatted now that you've said that. I want to re-watch it. A bad little kid moved into my neighbourhood. Nothing right, just nothing that looks so good. He don't wanna go to school and learn to read and write. Just sits around the house and plays the rock and roll music all night. Well, he puts some tacks on teacher's chair, puts your normal little girl hair. Now, Junior, behave yourself.
And then we have a track that was actually released in the US before it was in the UK. Bad Boy, another Williams cover.
It's a close call between this and Dizzy Miss Lizzy, but I think this just shades it as my favourite Larry Williams cover.
Yeah.
My note for Bad Boy, I can't say it out loud, my mum would be disappointed. But it's me very much appreciating how wonderfully John Lennon screams this song.
Okay.
In such a very attractive way. I love John Lennon screaming. It's just, nobody screams like John Lennon. And like Money or Twist and Shout or all these songs, his screams into guitar solos. Like, it is just no wonder that, again, that those would be moments in concerts where the girls would go crazy just to see him do. Like, they come from his toes, those screams. They're just so huge. And Bad Boy and Dizzy Miss Lizzy are very much him just screaming his head off and being very, very sexy. I mean, this is what rock and roll's about, you know? Like, if you can't listen to music like that and show that abandon and show that frenzy and show that energy, and what is the point of rock and roll if you can't show that? And Bad Boy is brilliant. It's such a tongue twister as well, and he sings it perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, those little bits before the Junior Behave Yourself bit, they're really quite difficult to get your tongue around. Because the funny thing, I really love Larry Williams as well. Like, He brings a little more of a comic edge to him, his versions. Like, I see him quite similarly into the way that I see the Coasters, where they do brilliant rock and roll songs, but there's always that element of humour to them.
Yeah.
And Larry Williams is quite like that as well, in the way that he sings Dizzy Miss Lizzy and Slow Down and all that kind of thing. Whereas John Lennon just lets rip, and I like it. This is why people should get into the early years Beatles. If you like rawness, if you like sexiness, if you just like surges of energy, you have to listen to the early records. You really do.
We've been in lockdown for a year. We need this now.
Absolutely. Maybe that's what we should do when we come out for the first time. We should just play Bad Boy or Money or something really loudly into the streets, and we can all sing along and scream. If you were red tonight, remember what I said tonight. Forever.
that my baby wore, and what's more is true. Yes, it is.
And then we move on to the B-side of Ticket to Ride, Yes It Is.
Oh, I love Yes It Is. I love it so much. It's very different to This Boy. I know that John, you know, in the later periods when he was, you know, again, when he was like, that wasn't very good, he kind of sort of just dismissed this as a This Boy ripoff. Mm. It's totally different to This Boy, because you can hear, you can really hear the doo-wop and the soul influences in Yes It Is, where, sorry, in This Boy, where in Yes It Is, there's more of a sort of folky, like Celtic ballady element to it than just as much as three-part harmonies. Like, it sounds like it could be like a folk song from back in the day that's been rediscovered and sung by the Beatles, just because of the lyrics as well, with that sort of folktale-y quality to the lyrics. You know, it sounds like a story that's been passed down from generation to generation about, you know, not wearing the red dress because because bad things happen to women that wear the red dress and all, or that kind of thing. There's a sort of, and that lovely guitar noise that they have in it. Is it guitar, actually?
Yeah, it's a tone pedal. Same one George used on I Need You.
Right, yeah, of course. And so it sounds completely different to This Boy. And again, this is another one that I used to sing with my sister and my friend.
Oh, wow.
And again, my friend would sing the George bit. For this one, I sang the Paul bit and my sister sang the John bit. It's crazy biscuits trying to work out this harmony, because it's a really strange harmony as well.
Yeah.
It's a really strange melody too. It's not...
Yeah.
There's a sort of weird quality to it that doesn't sound like a doo-wop song.
I think the melody to this is less like This Boy and veering more into Because territory.
Because
it's kind of meanders all over the place. Very difficult to follow.
Yeah. We tried doing Because as well.
Ooh, how'd you get on?
Me, my sister. We didn't. That was the one that we just couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
We were okay with the versey bits, but it was the bit where... you know, the sort of middly bit.
Love is all, love is you, that bit.
Yeah, that bit. That was when we just lost it and we couldn't quite work out what bits we were all singing. So we never quite mastered Because, but we did Yes It Is. I think I've got the recording somewhere.
If you can find it, send
CD.
It over, I'll play it.
No. No, these are secret recordings that will never see the light of day. But I always really liked singing it as well. Because I really liked doing the Paul harmony, that sort of sustained sort of high note, and the red is the colour that my baby, like, that's such a really, it was quite satisfying to sing.
Yeah.
And I really, really loved the sort of penultimate true as well, where they sort of changed the harmony slightly in the Yes It Is, It's True. See, again, that's like one of these moments in Beatles songs that you're just like, whoa, what's that? And it just...
That's a beautiful bit of tension, isn't it? Just into the, Yes It Is True, and then it resolves back down to the...
Yeah. They knew what they were doing, these people. They were just always chucking these wee little moments that are just brilliant. And I also read too that Cynthia really liked this song. She said it was one of the best ones that they did, which I find intriguing as well. That because again, it's quite a downbeat song about somebody not quite being over their previous love, which is interesting that Cynthia would love that song. So I wonder I don't know if there was maybe elements to do with his mum there. I have no idea.
Could be, couldn't it? Scarlet, with the clothes she wore. I don't know, there's something about the femme fatale, about the lost love.
Yeah. To think that this was the B-side to Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
And if you think that song is about a love affair ending as well, and this song was about somebody not being... It's like, for a major pop group who are, like, at the height of their fame, the whole world at their feet, and they're releasing such... a model in A-side and B-side, quite heavy, like A-side and B-side, and it still rockets to number one.
Yes, yeah. Well, the same with Help and I'm Down, really, lyrically.
Yeah, though, like, that's the thing, like, Help and I'm Down disguise the sort of the downbeat lyric with the melody and the harmonies and all that, whereas Ticket to Ride and Yes It Is are really quite, melodically they're quite downbeat as well. But I love it, I love it. I wish they did more three-part harmony songs, just because I do love them singing three-part harmonies so much.
You tell lies thinking I can't see. You can't cry cause you're laughing at me. I'm down.
And we end with the B-side of Help, I'm Down.
I love I'm Down. Again, it's Paul doing Little Richard. Like, it blows my mind that they recorded I'm Down yesterday and I've Just Seen a Face all in the same day. I mean, what is going on there?
I know.
Paul! And each one of those songs demands a certain vocal style, and Paul does it so brilliantly in each of them. He gets exactly what's needed in each.
I'm Down, Paul said, I could do Little Richard's voice, which is a wild horse screaming thing. It's like an out-of-body experience. You have to leave your current sensibilities and go about a foot above your head to sing it. You have to actually go outside yourself. A lot of people were fans of Little Richard, so I used to sing his stuff, but there came a point where I wanted one of my own, so I wrote I'm Down. That's like... Yeah, I want one of those.
So it sounds as if it was like,
just right, I'm down.
It sounds as if, like, he had to G himself up to be able to do his Little Richard impression, you know, just to... Because it is, like, it is quite a thing when Paul's at full throttle like that. I love the keyboard in it as well. I like the fact that it gave it a little bit of... like a little bit of a difference to the normal, like, rock and roll, like the actual Little Richard covers that they did in the Shea Stadium footage with John with his elbows on the keyboard, and him and George just laughing their heads off and missing their harmonies, and I love it. I love it so much. It just shows how much, even when they were feeling the pressure and even when they were... But they had so much fun together, and you totally see that in moments like I'm Down in the Shea Stadium concert.
So Vicky Riley, thank you so much for doing this. Overall, what does this album mean to you?
This album and all the early Beatles stuff just signifies joy and excitement and energy and optimism and curiosity and love. That's what I get all the time when I listen to early years Beatles records. And even the sad songs lift you up in a way that sad songs sometimes sort of help you wallow in a mood for some. But just this, everything about the early years of the Beatles just excites me so much. And it is just no wonder that the world fell in love with them.
Vicky Riley, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure doing this. I feel like... I feel like this is a bit of a dream come true, actually.